This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman, and it's time for the Kenai Conversation. The general election is coming up Tuesday, November 3rd, and the Kenai Soldotna House District 30 seat is up for grabs. James Baisden of Kenai is running as non-affiliated. He's facing off against Ron Gillum of Soldotna, who is the Republican nominee. Gillum is from Phoenix, Arizona, is married to Pamela, and has two kids. He's lived in Soldotna for 35 years. He's a high school graduate, has been a small business owner, and works as a heavy equipment operator. In Gillum's candidate statement, he says government spending is out of control. Quote, "The taking of the PFD will not solve the current spending debacle. Waste and special interests need to be cut out. We need to have departments justify their spending, become more efficient, and get rid of special interest slush funds that are draining our resources." Gillum further states, "The binding caucus must go away. It forces our legislators to sell their vote for the term. They must blindly agree to vote on the budget before they even know what's in it." He also says he would join the conservative legislators in Juneau to eliminate the binding caucus, deflate the bloated budget, and fight to restore the PFD. Gillum did not respond to requests for an interview, so we're only going to hear from James Baisden today. Baisden describes himself as a fiscally conservative Republican. He's lived in Alaska for 30 years and in District 30 for 22. He's retired from a 35-year career in public safety, working for 22 years in the Nikiski and Kenai Fire Departments. He currently works as the Chief of Staff for Kenai Peninsula Borough Mayor Charlie Pierce. Baisden is a veteran. He and his wife Rhonda have three kids. And we'll start off with, why are you running?
You know, the reason why I got into the race was for our children's future. Rhonda and I, my wife, had a conversation of what we wanted to see happen with the state of Alaska. We want to make sure that our children have the same opportunities that we had. And that's what's the most important thing to us right now.
What kind of opportunities are you afraid that they would be missing out on?
Well, we're about ready to saddle them with a lot of debt, just like we are at the federal level. Our governments are spending more than they bring in, and all we're doing is pushing it off on future generations. And we need to make the hard decisions today, and that's why I'd like to go to Juneau. I think I could go down there and build relationships, and hopefully with my background and what I've done in the past, that I could influence those hard decisions that we need to make. We have a $2.3 billion deficit, and it's only growing, and we're going to have to make some tough decisions.
Tell us about your background a little bit. You've certainly got experience working in government, so what do you feel like you could bring to the legislature?
Well, you know, I've been in Alaska 30 years. I've been here in District 30 for 22 years, and I retired as a fire chief out in Nikiski for 12 years, and I've been in the fire service here for many years. Been a public servant, responding to your emergency calls. So I've dealt with difficult decisions. I've seen wonderful people do difficult things with emergencies, and I think that helps me. Now I'm currently the chief of staff for the Kenai Peninsula Borough, and I've been doing that for the last 2 years. So my budget and experience at that level probably will help a lot, because just like at the state level, the local level is going to be affected with what the state can do for us. An example would be revenue sharing that we typically get has been reduced. Bond indebtedness that we get for our schools have been reduced. So what's going to happen is you're going to see the local municipalities and the local borough, they're the taxing authority. So they're going to have more pressure on them to raise revenue to do the things that the state can no longer do. So that's what's going to happen. So you're going to see that domino effect take place.
What do you think you would be able to do in the legislature to move the dial on any of those issues?
Well, we're going to have to take an approach to where We didn't get there in 1 year, so it's going to take us a few years to get there. It needs to be done in a way to where we can't do away with the with a lot of the basic services. I mean, we've got children in school here in the Kenai Peninsula, and we've got one that's getting ready to go to college next year, and we want to have strong universities. We want to have strong schools. We want to have public safety. Everybody talks about the roads that we have. So we've got all those basic services that we got to continue. So what we have to do is we have to look at being more efficient. We're going to have to look at where new revenues are going to come from and how we're going to get there. We have depleted the state's budget here over the last 4 years. The CBR has been depleted, so we don't have a lot of places to go to. They've got pretty much one bucket of money left, and that's the earning reserves over the permanent fund, and then it's going to be new revenue after that. So that's going to be some of the decisions that are going to have to be made.
Right. So as you say, projected $2.3 billion, billion with a B, shortfall this next fiscal year. So what, if you can give me some specifics, are there areas you think could still be cut, or would you be looking more for revenue generation or some combination of the two?
Well, it's going to have to be a combination of the two. It's going to be across the board. So I've said to the people that have come and listened to me is that if I'm doing my job right as your legislature over the next 2 years, I don't see how anybody could be happy with what we have to do. We're going to have to basically hit every group, every part of the budget, including looking at the revenue side of things. So that's why it needs to be done now, and we can't push it off. We can no longer push off what we see as the problem. You know, everybody talks about the PFD. The PFD is at the top of the list, and I want everybody to get the largest PFD possible. But to say that we can go back and do the statutory level and that kind of stuff, I think that's just rhetoric right now, because it's going to be difficult to be able to do that, because, you know, over the last 4 years, everybody has said they want to do that, but the deficit has gotten larger, and we went from $1 billion in deficit spending to $2.4 billion this year. How can we do that? So that's, you know, I want to be upfront with everybody that I think we're all going to have to probably pay into this situation.
As you say, the constitutional budget reserve has been depleted. There's not enough left to dig us out of a financial hole again next year. So really the only existing pot of money is that permanent fund.
Yeah, and every time we take $1 billion out of that reserve to balance our budget, that's $50 million in earned income that we will never get every year for the rest of the life of that permanent fund. And that's where I'm saying we're having the negative effect on our future generations, because every time we take another $1 billion, we take another $1 billion, it's just going to reduce the amount of the permanent fund we're going to have and those dividends, and it's going to reduce the amount that we can use towards government. So that's what I'm fearful of.
Okay. So if the solution for you isn't strictly tapping into the permanent fund, what would new revenue look like for you? Would you be thinking sales tax, income tax, oil taxes? What would you want to pursue?
Well, we're going to have to look at all three, and all three affect each of those groups differently. I would like to have the least effect on our working class, basically who's out there working for a paycheck. We have sales tax here locally that we pay, and it typically goes and it goes all to education. That's what sales tax is at the local level. So if the state gets into the sales tax realm, the local municipalities and the borough is going to have a hard time, because our sales tax will increase dramatically. If we go and do a income tax, it's another one of those doors that once you open up, you can never close. Probably the fairest way, if you do an income tax, is probably going to be a flat tax of some type. And that has to be looked at. And then we have to look at oil revenue. You know, there's no doubt that ballot measure one is going to be big on everybody's list right now in this next general election. And I'm against ballot measure one, but we have to sit down and we're going to have to look at what the oil industry is doing. And what I want to see is have a mechanism that rewards them for production that brings in more revenue for the state. Out here in this area in Nikiski, I can see how important oil and gas is to the communities, because, again, I worked in a fire service that heavily was funded by oil and gas. It makes a huge difference. And they're in a situation to where they're dealing with the worldwide market. You know, we think it's just simple that if we if we pass something that they can continue to play, well, they can just slow things down and go where it's more favorable, and that's what I'm fearful of. We want to give them the opportunity where they can still have the incentives to produce, and when they produce more revenue, that's more revenue for the state.
So not in support of ballot measure one?
Not in favor of ballot measure one. I'm a no vote.
How would you advocate changing our oil tax structure then? You sound like you're kind of trying to walk the line between incentivizing production and yet increasing state revenue off oil and gas. So that's a tricky balance. Do you have specific ideas for how you would like to see that happen?
Well, right now, an example is the state brings in 20 mils on oil and gas assessed value. So let's use our local area here. If we have a 3 or 4 mil rate tax on our local area on oil and gas property, the borough gets that 3 to 4%. The state gets 16 mils of that right now. So again, they're paying a pretty huge share. When I look at the top 15 producers in this borough and what they pay in taxes, I can tell you it's oil and gas at the top of that right now. So they're paying their fair share. I see that, and that's why we need them to produce. We need to get their production. You know, we've got Agrium, which is Nutrien out here. We need to see better production and more incentivizing to get them back online.
What could be done to incentivize production?
I can't see. You know, again, taxing them more is probably not going to incentivize them. We need to look at, here locally. I know we've done some tax incentives to where if you come in for the first 5 years, you get a break on your borough taxes. We may have to look at something like that on state, but, again, right now we're getting ready to open up three large productions up in the North Slope. They're still a couple of years away. You know, we're about 490 million barrels of oil right now flowing through the pipeline. We need to double that. That is the problem. We have seen that decrease take place over the years, and that's why we're in this position. And of course, $40-some a barrel of oil doesn't help us much either.
Right. Of course, the state doesn't have much, unfortunately, influence over the price of oil, but
they don't. And again, that's that worldwide market we're dealing with, and that's why we're going to have to. We're gonna have to reduce the operating size of our government. Our size of government is not going to be able to continue at this level. And I've dealt with that before too. Because even with my experience at the local level, when you work on trying to reduce budgets, every group that's affected is going to come out and oppose it, and that's the difficult decisions that have to be made. And then you're going to have to decide what's best for your community and what's best for your state. We may no longer be able to do everything that the state has done in the past to the same level. So it might be smaller levels, but I can tell you it's going to get pushed down to the local level. That's where the big decisions are going to be made, and those taxing authorities are going to have to decide what they're going to do, because right now the state doesn't have those taxing authorities where we have it. So if it's something that's important to us, we're going to have to make those decisions that we want to continue. That's the way I see it playing out over the next few years.
And of course, on the state level, there's some things the state is constitutionally required to fund, right? Education being the biggest one of those.
Education is a big one, and the student allocation is going to be a big number. And I'm afraid of what's happening right now. Of course, with COVID, and even right now, the school's just closed again with everything that's going on. And you talk to the administration, and they're losing hundreds, if not thousands, of school or children that are now going to go into homeschool. And Rhonda and I, my wife, we've homeschooled our children, and we think it's a great program. But the problem is that you've got these families that are leaving the school district, and they may not come back. So they're going to see reduced numbers. And then depending on how the governor comes out with his budget, that legislature is going to have to work on, hopefully he doesn't change those funding levels. But it's going to be a difficult path. And throw in the situation dealing with the bonding that the school district typically would get reimbursement from the state, that's almost non-existent too. And I just saw an interview on one of the newscasts the other day dealing with Mat-Su Valley and how it's going to affect them. We're fortunate because we don't have as many bonds out there as some of these other large boroughs, but that's the scary part about it. We've got a vulnerable age group of children right now that need to be in school. COVID is keeping them home, and we need to make sure that we get the kids in school as soon as we can, and we need to do it safely. I understand that.
So speaking of bonding and school construction projects, I mean, obviously the Kenai Peninsula Borough is pretty familiar with those situations. We've got two schools, the main one being Ketchumak Silo, that desperately needs to be rebuilt. Nanwalek School, I believe, is the other one that's nearing the top of the list of emergency needing a new facility. And from the borough side of things, the plan pre-COVID was to ask voters for a bond to do some pretty large construction projects and maintenance upgrades in the school district. Obviously, that's kind of out the window or on pause for now. It used to be that boroughs could rely on the state for some pretty significant help in large projects like that. That hasn't been the case lately. And you're on the borough level right now dealing with that end of the issue. And if you're elected, you're going to be on the state level dealing with the other end of the issue. So as someone who sees the need in a district for support for school construction, would you advocate for more debt reimbursement for construction projects in the legislature? Do you, as you say, do you think that's just going to be one of those things pushed to the local level? Where would you fall on that?
Well, again, I think that's where my experience comes in, because I've been in the mix here for the last few years dealing with that. And KCLU is a great example. Here we've got $10 million sitting there from the state, and we had to extend that because of the COVID situation. And you're right, the school district was going to go out to bond, and we're having great conversations right now with the administration, and they're probably going to be looking at a bond next year to see what they can do. And it's going to be a borough-wide bond that we'll try to bring KCLU and Nanwalek into the mix also, because they do have needs. One of the biggest issues dealing that we have to change at the state level is there's the educational standards that states that the way some of these schools have to be built. And again, in today's budget situation that we're dealing with, we ought to be able to do something to get to fix these areas, but to the level that we used to, we may not be able to reach that. And again, spending $15 or $20 million for a school that maybe has 40 students might not be the right way to do it. But if we could fix it at the state level to where we could get them a nice facilities, and maybe we have to do some of it also distance with them. But we need to make sure that we're reaching out to those populations too. And then what we've done here, we've deferred a lot of the maintenance that we need to do with the schools today. And I'll get back to it. That's where locally we're going to have to make decisions whether we want to bond or not. And that's what we're going to see probably on some of the ballots here in the future is more of that, and whether it's going to be supported. At the state level, it's not going to continue at the same levels. At best, if it stays even, that's going to be a win. There's no way, again, with the $2.4 billion deficit and everybody's going to be affected, that it's going to be able to increase. I don't see how that's going to happen in the near future.
So when you're talking about state standards here, I think usually in the realm of education, we think of curriculum standards, but you're referring to building standards for schools, certain square footage. They need to have certain facilities, certain, you know, a gym and all that kind of good stuff. That's what you're.
Yes, okay. Absolutely. So if we could do something there, and that's one of the things we've tried to do, you know, whenever it comes out of that bucket of money dealing with education, there are some specific standards that we have to use it for. And it's the state requirements. And if I could have some influence to change that, because we could turn around and do some great things in these communities if we didn't have such strict standards that really what it ends up doing is costing us where we're going to pay $300,000 or $400,000 a student for a facility. That's hard for a lot of people to get behind right now.
Okay. And speaking of education funding, again, just overall, I mean, the state's main mechanism is the per student allocation, right? Base student allocation. There's been other one-time money allocated for various things as well. Stick with the same BSA, try and raise the BSA. How would you want to approach that?
A win would be to stay with the same BSA if we can. Again, I can't see how we're going to be able to increase it in these times. I don't see how anybody can see an increase in where we're at right now. So, and that's across the board. As much as I want to support education, and I do, that I don't see how we're going to be able to increase right now.
Another area the state funds, of course, is roads, transportation. There's been a lot of topics that have gotten a lot of debate in that realm as well, one being the ferry system. What are your thoughts on supporting the ferry system?
Well, of course, the ferry system is important for those people who are off the road system, especially in Southeast. And in District 30 that I represent, it's not as big of an issue, but to them, it's just like their roads. And again, we need to come up with a more efficient system that allows the ferries to continue. And you know, maybe ferries aren't going on a regular schedule where you only have two or three people on one one ferry at a time, and you may have to delay, or the schedule maybe has to be decreased, but we still have to be able to move people around in those areas. It's their livelihood, and that's how we that's how they get their products out there that they need, and that's how they come back and forth to be able to get their health care and that type of thing. So again, I don't want to see it it can't go away, but it's got to be done in a better way, a more efficient way. And I would say probably what's going to happen is, just like everything else, schedules probably will be reduced in a way that that they didn't have before.
And for more traditional, what we normally think of as road maintenance, of course, highways and plowing. On the peninsula here locally, the big issue was concern over Silvertip being closed and what that would mean for highway maintenance through the pass and winter plowing and all that good stuff. Of course, costs money. So where's the balance in supporting that type of maintenance?
Well, the balance is what happens is that typically whenever budgets are reduced, what you see happen is that the reductions will take place out there in operations level. So the residents feel that, and that's probably not the best way to do it. If we're going to make reductions, we make reductions at the top, at the administrative levels. And as a legislature, what we do is we fund those areas, but we don't get to dictate how they do it. And that's going to have to be the governor's push to where whenever those reductions are taking place, he needs to basically make sure that his directors and commissioners aren't doing it at the end of the road, to where it's dealing with plows and snow, and it's got to be done at the administrative level. If we've got redundancies up there, we need to change that. We used to get lots of bonding money for roads, and that's another example of what we don't have anymore. I have 15 directors right now that report to me as chief of staff. One of them is the roads director, and he's got some great ideals of being more efficient when it comes to maintaining our roads. But we used to receive a lot of funding when it comes to that, and again, we're not going to see that amount either.
Public safety is another big one, of course, the state funds, and there's a lot of challenges in Alaska in that realm. It's a big state, lots of small communities, tough to be able to afford a trooper in every village. Domestic violence situations and, you know, Anchorage area certainly saw an increase in crime. So as someone who comes from fire service, is very closely aligned with the public safety folks, you've been in that realm. So is that an area where you try to look for efficiencies, or is that an area where you try to increase funding to support public safety?
Well, I am a big public safety advocate, and I worked for the Department of Public Safety for 3 years, went through the Trooper Academy as a deputy fire marshal, so I understand what the law enforcement side deals with whenever they're out in the field. They work side by side with my group of emergency responders, and they have as tough a job as anybody, and they're already stretched thin. Most people complain because we don't have enough troopers out there now doing the things that we want them to do. We have to continue to support them. We have to continue to give them the funding they need. I hate to repeat myself. It's going to be difficult to increase anything
right
across the board. Again, if we can maintain where we're at, to where we're not having a negative effect on them, that's going to be my goal.
Okay. And we'll continue down the list a couple more of things the state spends money on rather than the things the state could make money on. But the university system, another pretty tough one for the legislature.
Absolutely. And we need to have a strong university system. You know, we were talking earlier about you know, I've got my boy who's a senior this year, and I want him to have those opportunities to stay in state and go to our university. I mean, we need to have that for our young people, and there are going to be some, you know, the governor made an agreement, what was it, last year or the year before, to where the university has been taking some cuts, and I think they're planning for another $20 million this year, if I'm not mistaken, off the top of my head. And it's going to be one of those things to where the university is going to have to make some decisions on are we going to have multiple universities out there with redundancies at the top? Can we become more efficient and maybe not have the same type of classes at each university? But look, I love what they do. You know, and then bring it to the local level here. Bring the university down to our community college here and what that means to our community. And we do pay a small meal rate to help offset the college here that we have. And I've seen great benefits from that, because what happens here is in my line of work back as a fire chief, every paramedic student that we could get that attended that training here locally, we would hire. One of the departments would pretty much hire. And if we can hire locally, they'll typically stay with us for 20 or 30 years because this is their home. And we need to continue to make that a priority.
Yeah, KPC, which you're speaking of, has several programs, real-world skill training programs, oil and gas industry, certified nursing assistant, paramedics program. They're hurting too these days. I mean, you look at the KPC budget has not quite been affected to the level of the larger universities, of course, just because they didn't have as much money to start with, but they're struggling as well. And so you talk about maybe the local mill rate. So you're kind of proposing shifting more of that support to the local level then?
Well, we have, as a local taxing authority, we've got, I think it's a tenth of a meal that goes to the university, and it has for quite a while. For KPC, we may have to look at changing that to again, we have to make sure they're successful, because I think that's where we get the biggest bang for our buck. The nursing program, the paramedic program, you mentioned oil and gas. Mm-hmm. I mean, those students typically go right out the door and go to work here locally and become producers in our economy, and we want to maintain that. I went through the community college when I was growing up. It was a great system. I've attended KPC through a few classes. Rhonda got her degree over there, so we know how important it is, and it's made us successful. And it's something that we need to keep at the top of our list, just like we do with the other educational issues.
Okay, but doesn't sound like you're thinking about restoring at the state level some funding to the university system at this point.
I know I'm repeating myself. I don't see how we do it in this economy. That's what I'm saying, is how it's going to be difficult, because, again, everybody needs it, but how do we do it?
Right. $2.3 billion is a very large number.
It's a huge number.
So shifting to the other side of that coin a little bit then, beyond just things that we pay for in the state, ways that we can make money in the state. I mean, the go-to is usually oil and gas, of course. That's been the largest leg of the stool of the Alaska economy for decades. What else can we do in the state of Alaska to diversify the economy? What other areas could we maybe be generating some revenue?
Well, small businesses, we got to make sure that, God, what a difficult year it's been for small business here with the COVID situation and the negative effect it's had. Same way with our fishing industry. Our fishing industry suffered dramatically this year. We have to try to get a balance between our fishing industry that from the commercial side and the sports side. They have to be successful. We need to incentivize our small businesses to in ways to stay open. And, you know, when we were dealing with the CARES Act money that come from the state, one of the priorities was to try to push out as much as we could to small businesses, because they were the ones that were suffering the most. And they're the ones who bring in the majority of our tax revenue. When they're doing good, we're doing good. And we have to concentrate on that. I hope that this thing turns around and next year isn't quite as bad as it is this year, because from the property tax standpoint and the sales tax, everything's down right now. And I'm hoping that that we can push out some more help for them. And we had a second round here just recently, and it looks like we're getting we're getting the money where it needs to be. It's never going to be enough.
So, and you're talking about the Burroughs CARES funding program.
The Burroughs CARES funding that come through from the feds, right, through the state.
Right.
And small businesses have been at the top of the list.
And from the state level then, how do you think the legislature has handled coronavirus CARES funding, Do you think there's things they could have done differently? Are there things you would like to see them do going forward to, as you say, support small businesses or accomplish some other goals?
Well, I would like to, we want to make sure that they dealing with the relief funding that's coming through. We want to make sure that it does stay with the small business as much as possible. You know, the state had a difficult time. I mean, there's no doubt that when COVID hit, that they were trying to listen to, and they were listening to the medical professionals, try to do what was best to keep us socially distanced and to wear masks whenever we're in crowds, that type of thing. I love the educational part of what the state does. That's where I want to see most of their energy. I'm not in favor of any type of mandates coming from the state when it deals with this. Alaskans know what they need to do. We're here in this state for a reason, because we want less government, not more. I don't want the government dictating what it is that we do. They can educate us, and we should be able to do the right things. If I come into a place and they want me to wear a mask, I'm going to put a mask on. If I go into a business and they don't want to wear a mask, but I want everybody to have a mask, I don't need to go to that business. I have that ability to make that decision.
And there certainly were some state mandates, right, with the governor's office when this first came about. So would you, retrospectively, if you had been in the legislature, would you have advocated against doing those?
I think they made the decisions with the best intentions. I think they were listening to what was out there. But I think what happened is, of course, we saw what was going across the country and some of the areas and that were hit bad, and we weren't quite hit as bad. So I guess, again, in retrospect, we could have went back and maybe done some things a little bit less. But again, I can't second guess them, because they had their experts in the room giving that information, and they were trying to do the best they could with it. So again, I want to see us move forward to where we're trying to get things back on track. For example, our schools, you know, our children are essential. Our kids need to be in schools right now. We have a population of kids that the most positive thing they have going in their life is the schools. And you talk about domestic violence and that type of stuff. You talk about home life. There's home life and domestic violence issues that these children need to be in the schools. That's where they get fed. Let's make them essential and work on that, because that's what's bothering me more than anything right now. My children staying home. I've got a wonderful wife here who can homeschool and make sure they're still getting educated. Some of the other families still have to go to work, mom and dad, or maybe it's a single family. They don't have that same situation. And that's what I'm worried about as much as anything.
You're tuned to KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. This is the Kenai Conversation. I'm Jenny Nyman, and our guest today is James Baisden, who is running for the House District 30 seat, representing the Kenai Soldotna area. His opponent, Ron Gillum, did not respond to requests for an interview, so we'll get back to James.